Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The fuel in the Japanese reactors is going to be radioactive for millions of years to come. Right now, though, General Electric is trying to figure out the economic half-life. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Squarespace.com, an easy way to publish a high-quality website or blog. For a free trial, go to squarespace.com/marketplace.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's the 16th of March, Wednesday. Glad to have you with us. All 30 of the stocks that make up the Dow Jones Industrial Average were down today, so it would be unfair to single out just one company were it not for that company's role in the nuclear crisis happening in Japan right now. General Electric, ticker symbol GE, lost more than 3% today, capping a four-day tumble that has taken about $10 billion off its market value. GE, of course, designed one of the reactors that was damaged by last week's tsunami, and the company is now in somewhat of an uncomfortable position, given GE's efforts in recent years to rebrand itself as a green company. Anybody remember GE's Eco-Imagination campaign? Marketplace's Sarah Gardner has more now of our coverage of the economic effects of this disaster.
I need a good time.
Eco-Imagination from GE. It's technology that makes the world work.
That's a recent TV ad for GE's Eco-Imagination campaign. GE workers, including a few in what look like contamination suits, are happily line dancing to an Alan Jackson song called Good Time. GE told us today they've pulled that ad off the air. But GE's latest nuclear tech is part of the eco-imagination mix, right with wind turbines and solar panels. Standard & Poor's analyst Richard Tortoriello says the Japan disaster won't help GE's green branding, but he says keep in mind the extreme nature of this event.
So I don't think you can make the extrapolation from that, that therefore nuclear is just an unsafe, kind of ecologically unfriendly technology.
GE's multi-billion dollar investments in things like wind power and hybrid locomotives have helped it soften a longtime image as an industrial polluter. That image was cemented after the company dragged its feet cleaning up PCBs it dumped in the Hudson River over three decades. Many Wall Street analysts insist GE is safe from legal liability in this disaster, and the company has strongly defended its reactor design. But Michael Levy, an energy expert at the Council on Foreign Relations, says GE still finds itself in a tough spot.
What you do 40 years ago can come back to cause problems for your company today.
Right now, nuclear energy delivers less than 1% of GE's revenues, but the company wants to grow the business by selling new reactors to developing countries like India and China. And global nuclear sales are now expected to slow. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
The latest try at cooling the reactors at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant may turn out, in fact, to be the simplest. Crews have almost finished running a new power line into that plant. That would give them back control over the pumps that are critical to the cooling system. What's not simple at all is what part nuclear power ought to play in energy policy. Commentator David Frum sorts it out this way.
As radioactivity leaked from Japan's damaged nuclear reactors, uranium stocks plunged on world markets. And I personally did something I never do. I bought stock on a news report. For what it's worth, let me explain one new investor's perspective on uranium. The whole world is watching with anxiety and compassion as Japan faces the risks from radioactive emissions. Those risks are very real, and in the next hours we shall learn their measure. It's also true that a 9-plus Richter scale earthquake and tsunami represent about as extreme an event as any a nuclear reactor could ever face. If the danger from this shock is contained, nuclear will have passed its most extreme test. It's like the movie Apollo 13. This is either nuclear's worst disaster or its finest hour. At the same time, it is also true that the principal alternative to nuclear power is coal. And coal is an environmental catastrophe all its own. Coal changes our climate. Coal is dug from mines that collapse and kill miners. Coal ash emits more radioactivity than nuclear waste, reports Scientific American. Coal burning accounts for 92% of the smog creating nitrogen oxide in our air, 97% of the fine particulates we call soot, and 100% of the toxic mercury. One way or another, coal is estimated to shorten between 8,000 and 34,000 lives in America every year. The hazards of coal are less spectacular than the hazards of nuclear, in just the same way that the hazards of driving are less spectacular than the hazards of flying. Our minds seem to be wired to fear rare but spectacular hazards much more than we fear more familiar but more lethal hazards. That tendency explains bad energy policy. It does not excuse it.
Commentator David Frum was a speechwriter for the second President Bush. Today, he's the editor of Frum Forum. Robert Reich is up next week in the rotation. As I said to get us going, this was not a pleasant day to be a stock investor. We will have the details when we do the numbers. The Emperor of Japan has been on television, the Prime Minister and the Chief Cabinet Secretary as well, each of them trying to calm a very frightened population, which has been both physically and economically dislocated. Once again, we turn to our correspondent, Rob Schmitz. He's on the line from Yamagata, Japan. Hey, Rob.
Hey, Kai.
First of all, Rob, where'd we track you down? Where is Yamagata?
Well, I'm just outside the radiation zone from the Fukushima nuclear power plant. I flew into the closest airport to the reactors. So as you can imagine, there weren't many people on my plane. But one guy I met, his name is Hayami Setoguchi. He owns a business in Sendai. That's the city on the coast that was close to the quake's epicenter. Mr. Setoguchi sells prosthetic limbs. He told me that almost all businesses in Sendai are wiped out. For those that weren't damaged by the quake and the tsunami, the supply chain to the city is gone, so they have nothing to sell. Setoguchi is getting calls from hospitals all over the region for his product, so he decided to drive to the nearest airport, fly to Tokyo, and then fly back today. Since air, road, and rail are cut off from Sendai, this guy is slowly moving his own supply chain. And so I asked him what he thinks will happen to Sendai's economy, and he just stared at the floor. So here he's saying that he can't imagine how it's going to be. Before we think about that, he said, we need to have food and water and an infrastructure. He said he was going to have to wait for half a day tomorrow just to buy gas to drive back to his business in Sendai. They're rationing gas here to 2.5 gallons per car.
So what are people doing, Rob? I mean, are they staying put in shelters? This guy is obviously out and about, but is anything moving there in the local economy?
It's not moving very much. I mean, most people are staying put and rationing how much food they eat. I mean, it seems incredible in a country this developed, but in a matter of less than a week, parts of Japan have lost everything essential for an economy to run. In the lobby of my hotel this evening, I saw this group of guys wearing matching green jumpsuits. They were a bridge inspection crew, and they were going around determining which bridges in this region were still safe. They told me that people they saw in towns up and down the coast where the tsunami hit can only find food in evacuation centers, and even then, it's a few biscuits a day with a little water.
You had to bring your own water to the hotel, do I have that right?
I did. Some parts of this area that I'm in right now don't have water because they need electricity to pump it, and a lot of places don't have electricity. But there's another concern about possible contamination of the water because it's somewhat close to the nuclear reactors that are failing right now.
As you go about reporting out the story in the next couple of days and you talk to businesses, what are they going to be saying about the future, about when things somehow are going to get back to normal?
It's difficult for them to even think about this right now because they're trying to survive. But, you know, when you think about the future, you know, this is a country that rebuilt itself phenomenally after World War II. And I think a lot of people here remember that. And, you know, a lot of people have pride in their country here. And I think that underneath all of this are very optimistic about Japan's future, despite what's happening right now.
Marketplace's Rob Schmitz in Yamagata, Japan, west of the earthquake zone in Sendai. Rob, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Kai.
Early reports this morning were that Toyota was all set to start making cars again at the 12 factories in Japan that it shut down because of the earthquake. Instead, the world's biggest automaker has pushed things back for at least another week. Honda did the same thing. It's too early to put a precise dollar figure on the hit from factory damage and disrupted supply lines, but Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports the ripple effects are starting to spread globally from factory floors to financial bottom lines.
Toyota is still trying to get in touch with all of its parts suppliers so it can get a realistic idea of when it can start building cars in Japan again. The company estimates by next Wednesday it'll have lost production of 95,000 vehicles. Marianne Keller is an industry consultant. She says there are a lot of variables that'll determine how much this ends up costing Japanese carmakers.
It's not just that they're closed and not generating profits right now. It's the fact that when they do come back, they can't possibly come back at anything that resembles full production.
Goldman Sachs calculates the shutdowns will cost Toyota about $73 million a day in lost profits. So if the plants end up being shut for 9 days, that would mean a loss of more than $600 million. That's more than a quarter of its profit last year. But other analysts believe Toyota could recoup some of that later with extra shifts. Toyota suspended overtime shifts at its plants in North America to make sure it doesn't run out of parts that are imported from Japan. And a Honda plant in Mexico reportedly may furlough half its workforce because of supply disruptions. Dave Whiston is an analyst at Morningstar.
If you're producing outside of Japan, you have a lot less exposure to supplier part disruptions from Japan, but you're not immune because there's still a certain small number of parts that are coming from Japan to Toyota and Honda and Nissan factories in the United States.
Toyota says it's planning to restart production of some of those parts Monday, but there are still thousands more that come from other companies, and they may have to rebuild that supply chain. I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Coming up, Russian health officials try market dynamics to stop people from smoking.
The main thing that we were suggesting was to increase prices.
Yeah, it didn't work. But first, let's do the numbers. You need three words that'll drive down financial markets? Try these. Possible catastrophic events. That's what the European Union's energy chief said today about Japan's nuclear situation. And so the Dow Industrials very quickly plunged, closed down 242 points, a full 2%, closed at 11,613. The NASDAQ down 50 points, 1.9%, ended the day at 2616. The S&P 500 fell 24 points, almost 2%, finished at 1256. Tech stocks took a beating. Apple soured 4.5% today. IBM dropped 3.75%. Microsoft and Google both unplugged about 2%. Intel raised 1.8% today. Netflix initially rose 8% after announcing an original TV series starring Kevin Spacey. But the movie rental company wrapped up in the red, trading down 1.5% today. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note dropped even farther, 3.21%. That's pretty low. You're listening to Marketplace.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Squarespace.com, an easy way to create and manage a high-quality website or blog. Visit Squarespace.com/Marketplace and sign up for a free trial. Then choose a design and color scheme that's uniquely you. That's Squarespace.com/Marketplace. We thank Squarespace for their support.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. The Labor Department releases the Consumer Price Index for February, and the Conference Board issues its monthly index of leading economic indicators. The House Natural Resources Committee addresses gasoline prices. And the Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee looks at catastrophic preparedness. How ready is FEMA for the next big disaster? I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The United Nations is still working out what to do about Libya. The Security Council has yet to make up its mind on a no-fly zone, but events on the ground may make that decision somewhat irrelevant because forces loyal to Muammar Gaddafi do seem to be gaining the upper hand. They're pushing farther east toward the rebel capital of Benghazi. So what happens if Gaddafi prevails and stays in power? What about sanctions? And what about the oil? Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports.
The rebels did briefly control some oil facilities along the Mediterranean coast east of Tripoli. Now,
most of the export facilities are back in the hands of the government, but the fields are still in the hands of the rebels.
That's Tom Wallen, president of Energy Intelligence. He says many foreign workers have fled the country for their own safety, and the political uncertainty has left international oil companies unsure about whom they should be dealing with.
A lot of those relationships have been thrown into disarray. And so it's not clear exactly who owns the oil, who can sell the oil. If you buy the oil, who are you paying?
So far, most of the sanctions have focused on Gaddafi's assets, but there is pressure to expand sanctions to target oil. Again, Tom Wallen.
The U.S. government has placed sanctions on the National Oil Company, and as of yet, the European Union has not, but they're moving to do something similar.
If the international community does boycott Libyan oil, would it be effective? UC San Diego economist James Hamilton says no.
Where are we going to go instead? The wonderful regimes of Venezuela or Iran? Even at the tightest of a very significant blockade of Iraq oil, Saddam was still able to sell his product. I think somebody's going to buy the Libyan oil.
Gaddafi's regime is completely dependent on oil money. It financed this war. And if he faces a boycott, Gaddafi would likely offer bargain basement oil on the black market. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
It's Wednesday. Cue the letters music.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
You know what I love about our emails? I love what we learn about the people who listen to this program.
My name is Arden Herman Wildmuth, and I am 6 years old.
Arden lives in Kalamazoo, Michigan, where he and his mom write a blog about the birds they see at the feeder in their backyard. And they heard our story about the Audubon Society the other day and how it's reaching out to young birders, which Arden certainly is. His favorite bird, by the way?
Rose-breasted grosbeak, because it looks cool.
Other birders, though, wrote to point out that while technology has made birding more appealing to a less aged demographic, it does need to be used responsibly. Playing bird calls on your iPad during nesting season, by the way, not a good idea. We spent some time on public radio last week after NPR CEO Vivian Schiller was forced out over those fundraising tapes. When I asked media critic Jeff Jarvis about taxpayer funding for public radio and the possibility that it might go away as a result of all this, he said larger stations would probably be okay. Smaller, more rural stations, probably not. Greg Russell is the board president at WERU Community Radio up in Troy, Maine.
Loss of federal funding means a direct hit of up to 25% of our budget. Our coverage area is mostly rural and has limited internet access. It depends greatly on radio for news, public affairs, and entertainment. We offer programming for labor, health, boat builders, Native Americans, all locally produced.
Finally, in response to our story yesterday about corporate disaster aid going to Japan, Tessie Borden wrote from Los Angeles to say this.
Not a day, but only hours after reports of the Japan earthquake surfaced, I went to play Farmville on my laptop and noticed there was already a donate button that incorporates the game, giving folks a permit to plant daikons if they donate money to the effort.
Whether you play Farmville on Facebook or, like me, you just don't get Farmville, please do take a second to let us know what you think about the program. Go to marketplace.org, click on that link that says contact. For all the attention that the cost of the healthcare reform law has gotten, economists still haven't been able to put a specific dollar amount on the thing. That's in part because it's so hard to estimate the costs of disease. There's the cost of medical care, loss of productivity, intangibles that are far harder to measure. But it's one thing to try to figure those costs when you're talking about individual illnesses. It's entirely another when you apply those costs across an entire economy. Our healthcare correspondent Gregory Warner has the last of his series from Russia today on the battle between health policy and health care.
Picture yourself standing on a metro station platform in Moscow, just waiting for your train. Look around, you're bound to see two posters. One shows a smiling mother balancing triplets on her lap. It's urging women to have more babies. The other shows a cigarette ripped in half. It's telling you not to smoke. Those two omnipresent posters reflect two sides of one looming fear. that if Russia does nothing to increase its birth rate and lower its death rate, its population could fall by 30 million, 20% in the next 40 years. Okay, we can actually leave the station now. Let's head above ground to a tiny office at the Institute for Economic Forecasting in Moscow. Professor Boris Prokhorov is 83, 20 years over the average life expectancy for the Russian man, and old enough to remember when statistics was a dangerous profession. You could get arrested for publishing the results of a bad wheat harvest. Today he tells me he is free to publish whatever he wants, though his research into children's health has not made him a favorite with government funders. He reaches into his coat closet, it doubles as a library, and he pulls out his latest book.
Can't
show me in the radio. But...
I see a graph that's going from 1996
to 2004, and it's increasing, and that's the increase of children's diseases. Tuberculosis, cerebral palsy, alcoholism in teens, an assortment of conditions and disorders on the rise since the 1990s. And while the picture's improved somewhat in the past few years, along with the Russian economy, a 15-year-old boy in Russia still has a shorter life expectancy than a boy in Haiti. That's not just bad for Russians, it's bad for Russia's economic prospects. International investors use certain health statistics, like infant mortality and life expectancy, to gauge a country's economic future. So to deal with these troubling statistics, the Russian government announced a plan to build 23 neonatal centers across the country with state-of-the-art Western technology. One of those neonatal centers is being built here, in the ancient city of Yaroslavl, a four-hour train ride north of Moscow. The center has not opened yet when I arrive. The federal program has been racked with delays. So I stopped into one of the city's maternity wards. I meet the director, Irina Dmitrievna, a vigorous woman, nearly 6 feet tall with a blonde bouffant. She leads me to the preemie ward. There's an incubator and a tiny baby inside. The future neonatal center, she says, will have much better technology.
They're aimed at obtaining a healthy person who will go on to take an active role in the life of our city and our government.
She might have added our military as well. The army is worried about finding enough healthy soldiers to guard the borders. The Ministry of Defense is reportedly planning to tag newborn boys and track their health as they grow. Andrei Demin is a physician and a public health advocate in Moscow, and he tells whoever in the government will listen.
You should not be preoccupied with high technologies. Please look at how people are doing in everyday life. 48% of pregnant women do not stop smoking during the pregnancy.
Meaning almost half of women smokers keep smoking when they get pregnant. And Russia has more smokers than any other country. Some of the cheapest cigarettes, too, down to 52 cents a pack.
The main thing that we were suggesting was to increase prices.
Actually, this January, the government did increase prices a little bit. Last year, the cheapest pack was 35 cents.
I think it's a violation of human rights.
Yuri is a law student in Moscow. His brand of smokes used to be 60 rubles, about $2.10. Now, it's a whopping 250.
This is just profiteering by the companies and by the government.
Yuri is in the minority. Polls say that most Russians support some kind of price increase, but how much?
The more pressure people suffer with higher taxes, higher prices on cigarettes and alcohol, will make people rise in protest.
They rose in protest in 1985 when Gorbachev raised the price of vodka, a move that increased life expectancy to the highest it's ever been in Russia and sparked widespread resentment that some say helped bring down the Soviet Union. Andrei Demin tells me that tobacco lobbyists warned the government not to raise prices.
They often cite that, you see, there would be riots. And please remember, more than 70% of men in some age groups are dependent on tobacco. Tobacco is like bread. This is what they say. It's like bread. They need it every day.
Just in the last month, Russian officials made back-to-back announcements. The government is increasing its budget for high-tech medical equipment for the nation's hospitals by $160 million next year. And it's considering raising the price of cigarettes up to five times at some unspecified date in the future. Meanwhile, each year, 400,000 Russians die from smoking-related causes, and another 500,000 early deaths come from drinking.
Our government is at the crossroads. If they do nothing with alcohol and tobacco, the demographic problems would increase.
For the sake of its economic future, he says, Russia needs to convince people to live healthier. But for the sake of its political stability, its rulers have to be convinced that those people, denied their opiates, won't chuck them out of office. In Moscow, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
You can hear all five stories in our series and read Gregory's reporter's notebook as well at our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, in which I probably naively hope this will be the last time we'll have to say the word TARP on this program. The panel that Congress set up to oversee the bank bailout is winding down. It's going out of business this week, but not before issuing one last report. And so the all-time champion recipient of federal aid during the financial crisis, from all sources, it should be said, not just the TARP, Citigroup. Total package of $476.2 billion. Bank of America, a distant second, $336.1 billion. Not fixed at all, the report says, by the Dodd-Frank financial reform bill. That whole too-big-to-fail thing. And that is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media, this Wednesday. Today, the Dow tumbled 242 points, a loss of 2%. The NASDAQ down 50 points, 1.9%. The S&P 500 gave back 24 points, almost 2%. Vahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Bradford Craig, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineered the program for us. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news and an update from Japan as well. Coming up next time back here, the Middle East needs help. Question is, who's going to pay for it?
European states aren't going to provide the funding. I doubt very much whether the United States will provide the funding either.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.